I think we'll get going as soon as everyone's settled anyway. As you know, this is the last lecture of this series. I'd like to thank everyone for sticking with it so diligently. I mean, I really appreciate it, right up to the threshold of the exams, I do believe. So wish everyone good fortune in the exams as well. Now, in this last lecture, what I'd like to do is to summarize some of the themes of the lecture as a whole, but also focus them on the issue of politics and the question of what form and shape politics might assume under the impact of all the changes that I've been discussing. To summarize the overall arguments, we live, I'm claiming, in a world of intensified globalization, marked by the advance of manufactured uncertainty. Those two conditions, which reflect, of course, a whole host of other changes, to me, are the basic circumstances which lie in the background of the dissolution of Soviet-style society and the Soviet Union itself, the problematic nature of the aspirations of Marxism and socialism at the end of the 20th century, and the, at least one could say, severe troubles of the welfare state compromise in the West. Key part of my argument, really, is that the collapse of communism went along with the demise, or at least the troubled character of the Keynesian welfare state compromise in Western society. It's for this reason that one can't simply say that the West won. One can't simply say, I think, that Western society proved to be a superior form of social, political, and economic organization, because in the form in which it achieved that superiority in the second, post-Second World War period, that is, managed capitalism, capitalism with a human face, if you like, capitalism which is reconciled with a welfare system, that system itself has been placed under severe strain by the very changes that brought down the Soviet Union. We live in a world, certainly, of unfettered capitalism, or of a resurgence of capitalism. I mean, we live in perhaps the first global business civilization, something that Marx would never have anticipated, I think. But that is not a system where capitalism has accommodated to its own problems, and it's not a system where modernity simply has been released by the advance of global capitalism. It is a society fraught with problems. Those problems do include, I think, many of the problems that Marx diagnosed. And probably the most, you know, most basic one of all is, as Marx said, capitalism is a restlessly expanding and changing system. It is literally a system which cannot stay still. Anyone who's been in contact with a business enterprise knows that this is the case. Even universities increasingly becoming like this, I have to say. A system which can't stand still, a system which does operate in a fluctuating fashion, a system which does still produce oligopoly, all these are characteristics that Marx identified, and it is very hard to see, therefore, that capitalism can be genuinely equated with the end of history. It's very hard to see that such a system can accommodate itself to a finite world. I think when you think of a capitalism as a restless system running up against finitude, you should have in mind not just the finitude of ecology, not just the finitude of the Earth's resources, or the finitude of keeping the atmosphere non-polluted and so forth. You should think of finitude in terms of what it does to us as individuals, what our lives are as individuals. Just as a system which is organized through relentless, intensifying change, is inherently, in a certain sense, surely time-limited, much the same thing is true of our own personal lives. Our own personal lives, I think, cannot be lived as endless change. They cannot be lived as lives which don't have a moral framework. They cannot be lived as lives which don't integrate with some kind of overall sense of purpose, which is coordinated through stability. Capitalism, therefore, has escaped, if you like, from both sides of the equation. It's escaped certainly from the Marxian scenario, which saw it being supplanted by global socialism, but it's also escaped from the welfare state compromise, which for a considerable period did seem to produce a more humanized version of a capitalistic society. Now, the advance of globalization, I tried to stress, should not, you know, all contemporary intellectual culture to the contrary, should not be understood simply as an ending. I mean, we do live in a culture of endings where there's the end of history and the end of almost anything else that you care to name. Someone has written a book with that title. But it also makes sense to say that we still live in a world of beginnings. If you understand by globalization, as I would, the emergence of a global civilization, of the first in human history. I think we're in the early stages of at least the possible emergence of a global cosmopolitan society. That society is still being ill-defined in its contours. That society is still being led by market forces as they become globalized and by the impact of science and technology. That society throwing up risks which we don't know whether we can, in fact, effectively confront. The early stages of the emergence of global cosmopolitan society is very unsettling, and it's unsettling because we don't know whether it will be successful. We do not know whether we can contain the forces which we have released. As sort of the leitmotif, really, of late 20th century civilization. However, I tried to insist that globalization should be understood not as simply an economic phenomenon, not just as the development of global markets, however important they are, and they are important as a major source of dynamism. Globalization, I tried to say, is a shift in our personal lives, it's a shift in the institutions which surround those lives, and it's a kind of resettling of global institutions as a whole. Key part of all this, really, is what I would define as the experimental nature of modernity now. I mean, the advent of modernity was supposed to produce certainty. It was supposed to produce a secure world for us. But in truth, modernity at the end of the 20th century has become experimental. Modernity is like a grand experiment in which we're all involved, but it is not an experiment carried on under controlled conditions. We do not therefore know whether this experiment will prove to be successful. We have veered off, I think, from previous phases of human history in ways which are potentially emancipatory but which are deeply disturbing. What applies on the level of the collective institutions of modernity also applies on the level of individual life, as I tried to show in the lecture last week. There's a key sense also in which our own personal lives have become experimental. That's largely because of the unsettled nature of lifestyle patterns. We're all involved in what I've sometimes called everyday experiments. Every time you make a decision what to eat, what to wear, how to look, who to be with, whether to get married or not, whether to have children or not, these have all become much more open-ended, risk-infused decisions than they ever used to be before. There's a certain sense in which, therefore, the structure of market-based risk does infect other institutions in the society. And we're all in a kind of high-risk, high-investment situation in our emotional lives, much as investors are in financial markets. Many, many implications of that could be traced out. We're dealing, therefore, with two levels of the reorganization of social life, reorganization of global institutions, which continually, routinely, and deeply now intersects with the reorganization of everyday life. We experience late modernity in our bodies, in our emotions, and in our personal relationships, I think, often much more intensely than we do in the areas of public participation. This is, in a way, what the phenomenology of late modernity is like. in answer to an email I got about lectures which I did, in fact, answer by email, whoever, for the person here who sent it to me, this is not for me an era of postmodernity. This is not for me an era of postmodernism. We are stuck with modernity and its consequences. But modernity has turned out to be, for the reasons I've just mentioned, more problematic, more fraught, more limited, more double-edged than certainly the chief progenitors of enlightenment and modernity presumed. We cannot escape enlightenment, in my view, either. We cannot escape science and technology. They are, to some degree, the driving forces of these transformations, but they are the only avenues which we have to deal with those transformations. This is very easy to see on the level of ecological problems. We wouldn't even know that the Earth was faced with most of the ecological problems it is faced were it not for the activities of scientists and those who study nature in a scientific fashion. On the other hand, the advance of science and technology, as wedded to industrialism, has created those very problems which we still depend upon science to diagnose for us. A lot more could have been said in these lectures about our new dialogic relationship with science. Science and technology impinge on our lives so immediately, so profoundly, and so quickly that we can no longer confine them to a separate sphere of scientific testing and proof. We are all involved in everyday battles, as it were, with science and technology. Again, I recommend the study of diet and medicine as a good field to pursue that issue. Whatever you eat, you can no longer, I think, now be free from the implications of changing, mutable scientific theories and findings about the relationship between food and health. You can, of course, ignore those findings, but that is a strategy now. You cannot extract yourself from the world of industrialized diet to go back to a traditional diet, or if you do, it's itself a lifestyle decision, and actually a very difficult and expensive lifestyle decision to make. Now, in this lecture, I said I'd like to just comment on some of the implications of all this for political theory today, and to some extent political practice today as well. In my view, the intensifying of globalization does not lead to the end of politics, and it does not lead to the end of the nation state, as some of the more radical theorists of globalization have claimed. In a way, almost to the contrary, it certainly transforms the structures of the nation state, and we'll be seeing this happening with devolution and the issue of Scotland and Wales in this country over the next year or so. Certainly it transforms the nature of the nation state. But globalization actually makes political decisions, like economic decisions, in some ways more urgent, more pressing, and more consequential than they used to be before. If you consider, for example, the issues in British politics which the new government will have to face, they involve constitutional reform, the devolution issue itself, the issue of the single currency and EMU, the possible revision of the welfare state, the revision of educational system in global labour markets, all of these are issues which bear the strong impact of globalization. I think it's not too strong a statement to say that all politics now consists of responses to globalization, where globalization means living in a different world, a different institutional and personal world. However, all of these decisions are extremely consequential. They must be taken. They have to be taken by political actors. They normally have to be responded to on the level of national politics. It is simply not the case that globalization is antithetical to political power. It redefines and it shapes the forms of decisions which have to be taken, but those decisions are in some ways perhaps more urgent and important than they used to be before the era of intensifying globalization itself. Now, in this era of intensifying globalization, in this era of the collapse of Marxism, in this era of the disintegration of socialism, what remains for radical politics? I mean, what kind of role and what kind of shape can political life assume in this world? Now, I don't think the answers to this are clear. I think they're in the process of elaboration, and in the course of this lecture, I simply want to offer a range of comments which I think to be relevant to this question. If you look at the shape of politics, concentrating on Western politics, over the last 20 or so years, as you expect, you would find an interesting reversal of the relationship between socialist thinking, progressivist thinking in general, to the actual contours of politics itself. Briefly put, I think you can say that from about the late 1970s onwards, becoming accelerating with the collapsing position of the Soviet Union, socialism as a political ideology turned curiously conservative. That is to say, socialism previously was in the vanguard of history. I mean, you know, even those who opposed socialism did, I think, tend to accept that socialism was in the vanguard of the future. And of course, Marx made this into an overall historical scheme, socialism as the triumph of the long-term evolution of humanity. But it doesn't seem, and it's quite logical, it doesn't seem that way anymore. Socialism, what remains of socialism, is a defensive reaction to the global release of capitalistic market forces. That defensive reaction, especially insofar as it remains firmly linked to a position of leftism, tends to concentrate on defending the welfare state, protecting the existing institutions of the welfare state, protecting existing means of confining inequality in the face of globalizing forces. That is, in a way, socialism turned conservative, and you can see good reasons for it. I don't mean to say that it's completely mistaken to do this. On the other hand, what people haven't given enough attention to, I think, in political theory over recent years, is the fate of conservatism. And we see the fate of conservatism, I think, acutely portrayed in the British election of 2 weeks ago. Now, you could see that collapse of the conservative vote is simply contingent thing, that is, people had had enough of the conservatives being in power in this country for well on 20 years. But I think actually there are much more profound structural features behind this collapse, which are shared, problems which are shared by conservative parties in many other parts of the world. And just as socialism has become to some extent destroyed by the impact of globalization and manufactured uncertainty, so also has conservatism. My view is that the crisis of conservatism is at least as profound as the crisis of socialism, not just because conservatism was always a reaction to socialism, but because both respond to and can't really make good sense of the new world into which we have entered. What's happened to conservatism? Well, just as 20 years ago, socialism started to become defensive and conservative, so conservatism at that point started to become radical. I think you can say the most radical thinking of the past 20 or so years has not, by and large, been associated with socialism. It has been associated, curiously enough, with conservatism. The reason for that is the embrace by conservatism of free market neoliberal philosophies. Neoliberal philosophies which argue that the market should be generalized as far as possible, that the market promotes individual freedom, that at the same time the market promotes social justice, because market mechanisms eventually resolve all the difficulties which they create. They're like the invisible hand generalized as a theory of social justice. That took over conservatism in many countries anyway, over the past 20 or so years. Now it's clear, and some of the founders of neoliberalism, such as von Hayek at the London School of Economics, were themselves clear that neoliberalism is not compatible with conservatism, even when it calls itself conservatism as a political position and as an ideology informing a party system. It's not compatible with conservatism because the business of conservatism is to conserve. The business of conservatism is to conserve tradition, to conserve custom. The whole point of conservatism is to say that the past has an enormous amount to teach us about the future. And in my view, the notion of tradition was always a kind of key organizing notion, fundamental organizing notion of conservatism. Tradition embodies the wisdom of the past. Through the continuity of tradition, you preserve the wisdom of the past as a way of confronting the future. Conservatives were always against so-called progressives because they felt that social engineering, social planning, and orientation to the future simply threw away too much and also overgeneralized the perfectibility of human beings. Conservatism was always emphasized lack of perfection in human beings. With the transmutation of conservatism into free market philosophy, you then get an internally highly combustible and contradictory set of beliefs, I think, with which the Tory party here has been struggling and many conservative parties have been struggling. On the one hand, something close to libertarianism in the domain of the market, because market individualism and market freedom in the economic sphere is prized above all else. You must release market forces. You must reduce the scope of the state. You must make people free to take their own investment decisions. But that goes along with an attempt to preserve some of the more characteristic features of conservatism, which then take the form of a kind of authoritarian fundamentalism, an insistence upon the sanctity of the traditional family, an insistence upon the preservation of sovereignty, and an insistence upon national ideology, the ideology of the classical nation state, as the basic social and cultural glue. The problem with this is that market forces destroy tradition, as I tried to show in the last lecture. Market forces are among the most radical forces in society. We know, as you move into a global market society, that the impact of globalized market forces on tradition and custom is very intense and very profound. Conservatives, therefore, are left trying to reconcile two quite contradictory positions, I think. On the one hand, they're radicals in the marketplace. On the other, they're even more than conservatives morally, a kind of reworked authoritarianism, I think, often. Certainly in more pronounced forms of conservatism, goes along with market libertarianism. It's not surprising that this position collapses. And I think although Europe was nominally the kind of substantive issue which divided the Tories in this country, I think that the division is really one of a more profound kind, of which Europe was only the signal, the marker, the thing to blame, as it were, for the contradictions which the system can't handle. I'd therefore at least like to lodge the idea with you that the crisis of conservatism is as complete as the crisis of socialism. If this is so, one has to ask what remains from politics, what kind of ideology of politics could one have now, and is there any space indeed for a radical politics of some sort? About this, I'd like to make six or seven observations and then conclude the lecture with that, the lecture series. First of all, it seems to me that in modern politics, whether you define this narrowly or more broadly, maybe it'd be helpful if I write these down, I've got to use this thing, keep it in your mind. First of all, there is still a division between political left and political right, I think. There is still a worthwhile distinction to be made between left and right. Contrary to some people who simply say that division disappears altogether, it still seems to me important. I think probably the best recent work on this, if anyone's interested, is the work by the Italian liberal thinker Norberto Bobbio in his book, which is a very short book, which is very good, all books should be short, called Left and Right. This book, interestingly, sold about 300,000 copies in Italy and was sold very widely on the continent. Very hard to imagine this country, a book called Left and Right, appealing to the popular consciousness in that way, which shows something about this country, I think, really, and its relatively low level of political discourse and interest. Now, Bobbio argues for a position which I think is, in essence, correct, except that I think, in the end, the claim falls far short of what he advocates. Bobbio says the division between left and right now roughly runs as follows. Those on the left hold two core beliefs which differentiate them from those on the right. The first belief is that social inequality is to be contested and reduced wherever possible, this being a major political value. Second, people on the left believe that whatever's happened to the nation state, that the state and government can still provide a means to this end, can still help to reduce inequality in a society, no matter how that form of government intervention is conceived. This seems to me, broadly speaking, correct. This still seems to me to mark a differentiation between left and right in orthodox politics. Rightists, on the whole, don't have the same feelings about inequality. On the whole, they believe that the state, the scope of the state, should be reduced. They don't believe that the state can do the things which people on the left still, on the whole, tend to believe it can do. I mean, this might take the form of a partnership of the kind which Tony Blair talks about, and the many different forms, of course, which state involvement can take in the aim to reduce inequality. This having been said, I mean, I think for this reason, among others, there are other reasons why left and right will continue to make a difference in politics, because it's an easy way of identifying political positions. It has a kind of visual form to it, which is difficult to escape from. There are other reasons, too, why a division between left and right is still likely to be an informing division in national politics and in broader political spheres as well. However, this having been said, my view anyway is different from Bobbio's in the sense in which I think that the division between left and right now only covers one sector of the political decisions which face us. That is, there are many political dilemmas and issues, I think, today, which don't fall into an easy left-right distinction. And that's why, in the book I wrote about these issues, I called it Beyond Left and Right. Left and right still have an organizing overall significance, but they don't define some of the core issues for us. This is true, I think, with very many of the issues that I have discussed in this course. The question of globalization itself, how we should respond to globalization, what globalization is, what it means for our everyday lives, is not simply a left and right issue. You can trace out left and right remnants, as it were. The globalization skeptics, as I called them, tend to be towards the old left. The hyper-globalizations, as I called them, tend to be on the political right. But there is no clear-cut division of this sort. How to respond to globalization is a fundamental issue for us, but you can't really define it in terms of the old conservative versus progressivist politics. I mean, I think this is fairly clear, for example, if you consider the issue of ecological politics. One of the main responses to globalization we have to make politically is to contain and transform the ecological implications of market-based industrialism, which, as we know, are potentially extremely destructive. What is ecological thinking? Well, ecological thinking is often associated with the left, but it seems to me quite plain that it has no distinct lineage on the left. Ecological thinking, after all, is about conservation, it's about protection, it's about caring for future generations, it's to a large extent preserving the past into the future. What are these? Well, these are certainly traditionally conservative themes. Ecological politics, I think, largely transcends old left-right divisions, but it's a fundamental form, perhaps the fundamental form of politics, I think, for the early part of the 21st century. This also applies, I think, to the family values debate and many other debates which beset us. You can easily see a continuing division between views on the left and views on the right, but they don't any longer define the core issues in the family values debate, I think. If we're going to push that debate further, we have to get beyond trying to force it back into a left-right division. It's a debate, like ecological debates, which demands radical solutions, but I think one now has to accept that radicalism does not mean the same as being on the left. As I tried to show just now, that equation has already been broken when socialism turned conservative and conservatism turned radical. I think many problems we face, they do demand radical solutions. Let me just continue with ecological politics as an exemplification of that. But those radical solutions no longer belong either to a single class-based group, and they don't simply concern the issue of inequality, however many forms of inequality may be linked to them, and however important the issue of inequality still is, as indeed it is. This means, to me anyway, that it does make sense to take seriously in modern politics an idea which many people deride, the idea of the radical centre, which I tried to persuade Tony Blair, New Labour, of, and has made some use of it. By the radical centre, I mean that you can hope to get consensual support for policies which are radical, but which don't depend upon class-based support, and which presume an alliance of forces of the which cross-cut class divisions, however much in some part they overlap with them. Just to use this, going through as only one example of this, but quite a good example, ecological politics falls in this category. For instance, to think about what the future of London will be, to think about what the future of cities will be, to think about the future of the transport system, these are basic questions for the current Labour government, or for any government which would be in power today. We cannot deal with the impact of the motor car without taking quite radical steps and certainly contemplating quite radical policies. These are radical policies not just to do with limitation of motor car traffic, but policies which impinge on crime and the regeneration of urban neighbourhoods. Such policies are truly radical, I think, but I think you can generate potential support from them from a political centre. Radical centre, therefore, means, as it were, a new alliance of forces in politics. And I would even go so far as to say that in the recent British election, you do see, in a certain sense, the radical centre in action. What the alliance of Labour and Liberal Democratic votes was a kind of partial invention of proportional representation through tactical voting, which was a vote, I would take it, for constitutional reform, for opening up the possibilities of devolution, and for other aspects of the modernisation programme which both the Liberal Democrats and the Labour Party proposed. A lot more could be said about that than I have time to say here. Fourth, the orthodox political sphere is joined very importantly by the emergence of what the German sociologists I've mentioned before, Ulrich Beck, calls subpolitics. Basically, what's happening in politics is that as the structure of the nation state changes, as globalizing forces impinge both from below and above the level of the nation state, as they reshape political decisions, so you get not, I think, as many people say, a depoliticization of social life. You do actually get a repoliticization of social life, which, however, is organized through self-help groups, globalized associations, pressure groups of many kinds, many of which operate on a local and a global level simultaneously. I think the Brent Spar issue was a kind of marker of the expansion of subpolitics. Subpolitics is political engagement outside of the sphere of formal politics, operating not just normally anyway on a national level, but engaging with orthodox politics and forcing politicians to respond. I think the next few years will see an elaboration of the significance of sub-political issues in our lives. One material way of charting this is if you compare membership of orthodox political parties with membership of self-help groups, the difference between the two is quite amazing. It's a tremendous proliferation of special interest and self-help groups, many of which have quite narrow political objectives, other of which still have political objectives, even though they're more diffuse in character. There is no way that the spheres of orthodox politics will be able to ignore the issues which are thus brought to the fore. This does not, I think, represent, however, a new mode of governance. You can't say it is that, because you couldn't have government which was simply a congeries of special interest groups. You must have government which decides between the competing claims of a diversity of special interest groups, and you must have both a local and an international legal system which adjudicates between them too. So although you, for example, have pro-life groups and pro-choice groups locked in mortal combat with one another, both the state and the legal system has to take decisions at any point in time about what the normative state of affairs is defined as in relation to these struggles. But they certainly won't be able to ignore the activities of these groups, which will probably get more intense rather than less intense in the years to come. This is a kind of reflexively mobilized global society, I would say, in action. And it has many possibilities within it. Fifthly, I feel, as a result of the changes I've been sketching in, we should draw a distinction between what I call emancipatory politics on the one hand and what I call life politics on the other. I think one of the key changes in politics with the emergence of globalization as the key agenda and the emergence of a politics beyond left and right is the increasing centrality of life political decisions to political agendas. By emancipatory politics, I mean a politics which operates within the old framework of left versus right. Emancipatory politics, at least seen from a progressivist point of view, is a politics which is about decreasing inequality, which is about contesting inequalities of power, which is about increasing human rights and prerogatives of democratic participation. It is a core part of politics and still remains a core part of politics. It is also the key part of the arena which tends to separate left from right, both within the area of orthodox politics and in sub-political domains as well. However, I think it's increasingly joined by an expanding arena of life politics, which also transcends the division between orthodox politics and sub-political spheres. If emancipatory politics, you can say, is a politics of life chances, it's a politics of inequality, whether it's power or economic inequality, it's a politics of the distribution of life chances. Life politics is a politics of life opportunities, because life politics is a politics of what happens when tradition and nature disappear. With the end of nature and the end of tradition, as I stressed in the last lecture, there are many new decisions which have to be taken. They're not necessarily taken, of course, by those whom they most directly affect. The expansion of the arena of decision making, consequent upon the disappearance of nature and tradition, opens up enormous spaces for political involvement. These spaces include many areas, I think, with which we're unfamiliar with thinking about as political, but which plainly are political because they demand an ethics, they demand a policy, and they involve a clash of values. Just to take one example, one area of life politics is the politics of the family and reproduction. As I tried to show in the last lecture, the reason why the family debate is so intense, the reason why it impinges so much on the preoccupations of politics now, is that the debate about the family occupies the terrain left by the retreat of nature and the retreat of tradition. The decline of these, as they define gender relations, as they define sexuality, as they define marriage, as they define the family, means a politicization of family life. There is no way round such politicization. There's no way round, for the reasons I just mentioned, the state being involved and the legal system being involved in these things. But they shift the characteristic ordering of political debates. The same thing is true of ecological issues, which I stressed earlier. And particularly, I think, that the same thing is true of our engagements with technology. I mean, I've tried to stress throughout these lectures that a part and parcel of the runaway world is the intensification of scientific and technological change. We're not used to thinking of this as political because it's normally thought to be confined to the sphere of economic development. But anyone can see from the episode of BSE, which I discussed briefly in an earlier lecture, that this is political. The BSE episode has already cost the country an enormous amount of money, probably £10 billion, may cost the country a lot more in the future if there is a stored-up epidemic. You shouldn't treat it as a deviant example. It is a marker of many similar issues which will be faced. The politicization of technology, therefore, becomes actually a basic feature of government, or is likely to do so. Any government which simply leaves technological advance to the side and doesn't have a strategy for coping with its implications will find itself embroiled in numerous such episodes. Well, I was going to add to the list, but I think I'll actually leave the list at that point, but there are other points which could be made. Let me just, by way of conclusion, bring this back to the more mundane area of British politics and try to show how even the most high-flown considerations about modernity do have nitty-gritty implications for political policy making on the ground. I think you can say that in the history of British politics in the post-war period, there have been two phases of the development of political thinking which have been influential across the world, in each of which British politics has been centrally involved, and I should stress this in this setting, in each of which the LSE has also been centrally involved. The first was the evolution of the post-war welfare state, the Keynesian welfare consensus of which I spoke earlier. It was in Britain, in some substantial degree, that welfare capitalism was pioneered by the Labour Party, in this instance, after the Second World War. And I'm sure everyone here, having read every word of Dorrendorff's History of the LSE, will know the LSE's involvement in this. The LSE was the place where some of the most prominent ideas which were built into the evolution of the welfare state were produced. In the works of writers such as T.H. Marshall, Titmuss, of course the work of Beveridge himself with the actual construction of the welfare state, Attlee as the British Prime Minister who presided over this, who was an assistant lecturer at the LSE. The LSE was a kind of powerhouse of ideas, really, for this system of welfare capitalism. But Britain in general was the laboratory of the world for it. It was succeeded, as we know, by the phase I also mentioned earlier, the phase of neoliberal thinking, that is, free market philosophy. The homegrown version of this was Thatcherism. Thatcherism was a particularly prominent form of neoliberalism, which, as everybody knows, had a strong influence in many countries across the world. The LSE also played a significant part in this, contrary to the 1960s image, perhaps, of the LSE. In the writings of von Hayek and other authors, and in the role played by some prominent academics here who were Mrs. Thatcher's early advisors, the LSE was also a central institution in the evolution of neoliberalism. Britain, too, again, was a laboratory to some degree for the testing ground for neoliberal policies. Now, I think you can argue, we stand in a third phase of political evolution. That third phase of political evolution is the phase of coping politically with a globalizing economy and a globalizing society. Neoliberalism, I think, as even its strongest proponents tend to accept, and as the very fate of the Conservative Party indicates, is not an adequate theory of a globalized society, nor is it even an adequate theory of a globalized economy. The reasons are that it does not have an institutional theory. Neoliberalism treats markets as though they were simply autonomous, whereas all markets depend upon a wider institutional framework of social reproduction. And neoliberalism, as has become, I think, clear, has consequences which are destructive. Not just the destruction of tradition and culture, but increasing inequality on a global scale and on a national scale of the kind which indeed Marx predicted would happen were ever a global market society to come into being. I'd like, therefore, to leave you with the thought that we now are entering a third phase of political thinking, in which I would like it to happen that both the LSE parochially and Britain more generally play the same kind of role as they have twice before in post-war politics. The LSE should be the laboratory of ideas which informs a new politics of a globalizing society, which moves beyond the limitations, at least hopefully, of neoliberalism. And British politics in general should be again a pioneering moment, I think, for not only thinking about but enacting some aspects of a new program. What would this program be? And I have to say, I think this program is in the process of development, but I think the ambitions of such a program are actually quite clear. Whether we can realize these ambitions, we don't know, but you know, the ambitions are quite clear. What we seek to create, I think, and I think this actually transcends party politics, although I have strong sympathy with Tony Blair's attempt to revise what used to be a socialist party in this way. I think these, to some extent, transcend party politics. What we're all looking for, I think, is to try to show that a society which sustains values of the left, that is, which is inclusive, which manages to create social cohesion, which manages to create security for people, which doesn't leave people outside, which still recognizes criteria of social justice, we need to show that such a society is not only compatible with successful global economic competition, but is indeed the condition of it. I think that the next phase of economic, social and political thinking beyond neoliberalism will seek to demonstrate this, that cohesion, solidarity, inclusiveness, some degree of moral consensus in a society, these are actually facilitators of effective global competition. They're not inhibitors of it. There is already, I think, fairly strong evidence to indicate this is so. If you look at empirically at the most successful societies economically, and you take not just a narrow version of economic success, but a wider series of criteria of what economic welfare is, there seems to be quite a strong correlation between lack of inequality or the containment of inequality, the preservation of moral consensus, and economic success. I think there are logical reasons why there should be such a connection. And I do hope that everyone here will play a part, just as the LSE should play a part, in seeking to pioneer how we might make such values compatible with the new globalized world in which we now live. And I'd like to thank you very much for attending and wish you all good fortune in the exams. Thanks very, very much.